Hey folks, this is AJ Croce. You're listening to Life Minute.
Son of late folk rock visionary Jim Croce, AJ Croce became a piano virtuoso at a young age, destined to follow in his famous father's musical greatness. At just 18, he toured with B.B. King and later with Ray Charles before reaching 21. After the tragic loss of his father in a 1973 plane crash at just 2 years old and a total loss of eyesight for 6 years, the musician and singer-songwriter has proven his continued resilience over the past three decades, releasing an impressive catalog of 11 studio albums. His most recent, Heart of the Eternal, yet another wonderful work from the uber-talented artist. Fresh off the heels of his successful Croce Plays Croce 50th Anniversary Tour, which celebrated his father's iconic work, he stopped by the Life Minute Studios to tell us all about it and more. This is a Life Minute with AJ Croce.
AJ Croce in the house. Such an honor and a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much for joining us on Life Minute.
Hey, thank you for having me. It means a lot.
Oh, it means a lot to us. So, a new album. Is this your 10th or 11th album?
This is the 11th album. I can't believe it. It's amazing. And it was such a fun project. You would think that after all of these albums that it's kind of, they run together, and they don't. They really have unique moments. Sometimes it's just because of the time you're in life. Sometimes it's the what's going on in the world. Sometimes it's just because the people you get to work with. And in this case, it was all of those factors.
And it's so good. It's so cool and edgy and funky and heartfelt, all of it at the same time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
What did propel it?
Well, you know, I had recorded an album of covers that was released in 2021, and it was partially due to the situation in my life, and it just felt better to do these songs, which were celebrations at that time. And so it had been a long time since I released an album of original music, and I write every day. So I was picking and choosing and trying to find material that was really representative of what is inspiring to me. All different genres, eras, styles, but finding a sort of through line with it as far as they're all representative of who I am. I think I came to realize that my strong suit as an artist is the fact that I am so influenced by other music. And finding a way to pay tribute to something or tip the hat to a genre or style or era without using it as a crutch or wearing it on your sleeve, this became my calling card. It was using these different styles to create something new. And it took me a long time to realize that that was a good thing. You know, it always felt right. But on this record, it sort of all solidified. And I became really conscious of the fact that, like, I am drawing from all these wonderful places, musically, artistically. But the way that I'm doing it and the way that I'm presenting it and writing songs around those things is very much who I am.
Who are you?
On any given day, you know, who am I? That's a tough question in that, you know, we are walking emotion. We are constantly changing our moods and ideas in terms of how we feel in a given day, and who we are in that day is completely driven by our confidence in what we are doing, what we're saying, how we're feeling about ourselves and other people. You know, I love life, and I love what I do, and I wake up an optimist. Even if I see negative things in the world every day, I think that I feel like there is a way through humor and music and art and life to have a wonderful time. We're just not here very long, so I feel like we really have to take advantage of it.
I love it. You're such a beautiful person. I can sense it already, and you've been through so much. You lost your wife in 2018,
yeah.
18, was it? Okay. And that prompted Reunion?
You know, Reunion actually came out of a song. It was a song that John Oates and I wrote. He had just visited his 100-year-old father. He was 100 years old, and he came back to Nashville from Philadelphia, and we started talking about it, and he said, you know, My father told me that he's ready for his reunion, that he is ready to reconnect with the people he's lost and loved. And I thought this is really a beautiful sentiment because we've all lost people in our lives that are important and special. And we understand that whatever our ideology is, or religion or faith, it is beautiful to think about that other side and being able to potentially see the people we love. And so that's what the song came out of. It's interesting, Reunion. Also, The Finest Line was another song on Heart of the Eternal that really talks about that other side. And it's not just because of my own personal experiences, but of course it's drawn on all of them.
Mm-hmm. I like your version. I interviewed John actually a little bit ago, and he just loves you too.
Oh, he is so wonderful.
What are some of your other favorites on the album?
You know, I'm really proud of this record, so it's hard for me to say, but I got a feeling it has this like psychedelic soul vibe to it. You know, it was inspired by Chambers Brothers, Shuggie Otis, Sly and the Family Stone, and I get to play lead guitar as well as the keyboard solos on it. So it was really fun to do that, and it just flowed. Hey Margarita was another one where I was like, this groove, it just feels right. And it was inspired by two totally different guitarists that I was thinking about. And you need to know I'm a piano player first, but as I've thrown myself into the instrument over the last 20 some years, I've become just a fanatic about it. I love to practice. I love to write on guitar now. Still, piano is my first instrument, but it was in Hey Margarita that I sort of tried to evoke the spirit of both Hubert Sumlin and Link Wray, who were very different in their way, but it's a blues song. It's relatively simple. The thing that is unique about it is that it's a blues song that is based on a mid-20th century Russian novel, which I think a lot of blues songs are these days. I'm just kidding.
Oh, that's great. Want to tell us about any other ones?
You know, The Finest Line was really unique. I did not conceive it as a duet. The way that it came about was that on my day, the travel day to Los Angeles from Nashville, where I was going to record with Shooter Jennings and work in the studio for a couple weeks and make this record, I was looking at all the material that I had compiled and had many more songs than I needed for this, but wanted to like go through it with Shooter and just see what we were working with. And that song, I had written it on guitar. And then when I transferred it to piano, it came alive in a different way. And then I had been touching up the lyrics on that song for probably a year. I would play with it and then I'd put it away and play with it and put it away. And it wasn't like the top of my list for completing. It was, in a way, it was an exercise. What happened was that Margo Price happened into the studio, not planning on singing or anything, heard what we were doing and was like, if you need someone to sing, let me know. She was in LA visiting for you know, a period of time. And so it was really cool. I took this song that was not even on my mind for being on the record necessarily, realized that if I broke the verses in half and made it a conversation, it was really meaningful. And it had something that was really ethereal and somehow, you know, profound.
What about So Much Fun?
You know, I'll tell you, So Much Fun came about because of that time a few years back where we got to stay home for a year. And at first I had taken it really personally, you know, because I was told I was non-essential. And, you know, and I'm like, music saves lives. No, but the reality is I was non-essential. And so it took a couple weeks for me to embrace my non-essentialism. And I was watching, you know, TCM and all these great old movies and, you know, brushing up on my French and my Italian. And as time went on, I was practicing scales from countries I'd never been to or will never go to. And I got a pair of tap shoes because I was watching all these old movies with like the Nicholas Brothers and Sid Charisse and Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and I thought, okay, well, I can tap dance with my fingers, maybe I can do it with my feet, but as it turns out, I can't. And I discovered in that moment that tap shoes are like Prozac with like far fewer side effects, you know? And the reason is because I would be walking down the hall and I would hear click, clap, click, clap, click, clap. And because I just, my costume of the day was my tap shoes, my bathrobe, and my motorcycle goggles, you know? I mean, if someone was, you know, at the door. And so I'm walking down the hall and I'm just laughing at myself, right? And it's hard to be depressed when you're laughing. And so I get back to, walk back to my room, and I'm just laughing at this whole preposterous thing that I've concocted. And so I'm thinking at a certain point of inviting friends over, and I finally invite folks over. I love to cook and listen to music with friends, make music with friends. It was like this really wonderful evening, and I hadn't seen anyone in that proximity in nearly a year, and it was like just amazing to see these wonderful, talented people, and I just could not believe that after 2 hours of being in contact with people I hadn't seen in over a year, I would feel that, I don't know, I just felt like I cannot wait for them all to go home. So I wrote a song about it and called it So Much Fun. Anyway, yeah, you know, another song that was really, really fun to put together on this album was Turned Around. Turned Around is kind of a unique song. I don't know if it's going to be a single, but it was an exercise initially in lyric writing. It was an exercise because I was trying to string these oxymorons together and make sense out of nonsense. And when I couldn't, I created an oxymoron of my own that would tie it together to the next line. And so there's these idiosyncrasies about the song and about the each line of the song that, you know, it was part of a writing exercise that became something really fun and interesting. And putting kind of quirky, unusual chords underneath it really added something kind of unique.
Yeah, so cool. Is that how it works for you? Do you come up with the lyrics first and then the sound? Or?
That one was unique in this way. Like most of this album, you know, with the exception of Reunion, which I wrote with John, and we wrote it in the moment, both the music and the words together. But that one, I wrote the words first. The other songs on this album were kind of unique in that I wrote all the music before I even presented the music to a collaborator, if I did collaborate on the song. And it really changed, you know, I've done that in the past, but it really changed my perspective on how to approach the song. Because I lived with some of these pieces of music for some time, like Complications of Love, even Hey Margarita, and I Got a Feeling, before I really came to a storyline that really was compatible with the music. And I think that was the interesting part of it, was like the music was already completed and it wasn't in the same time frame. Sometimes it was months later that I would go back, listen to the music and go, oh, I know what this reminds me of. This makes me feel this way. And I think it was that sense of feeling and emotion that it drew from the music that allowed me to write lyrics that were really compatible and really suited the songs in a way that I really don't think I had before.
That's so interesting. And you have a great band too.
I've got an amazing band.
Are they the same band on the album?
Same band that's on the album. Okay. I mean, just iconic players. Most of them have all won Grammys for their musicianship. And, you know, Gary Malibur, who plays drums, he was with Van Morrison on Moondance and Tupelo Honey, St. Dominic's Preview. He was with Steve Miller for 28 years on all those records. And Joe Walsh and Frampton and on and on. And David Berard, I've known since I was 19. He plays bass and sings with me. We met when he was with Dr. John, who he was, you know, with for almost 40 years. And between Mac and Etta James and B.B. King and the Neville Brothers, all of whom I had played with, you know, kind of got my start with those guys. And I was on tour with them after he had played with them. So it was kind of cool when we met. We had this immediate connection. And of course, Alan Toussaint was our other connection. And James Pennebaker is playing a guitar and a bunch of instruments. James is a wonderful utility player, great fiddle player as well as guitarist and steel player. He can play anything you give him with strings. He's wonderful. And I met him on the set of Austin City Limits when we did that, 30 years ago. He was with Leroy Pornell on that show, but he was with Delbert and, I mean, just so many artists he's toured with and recorded with, I can't even begin to mention. And the ladies are so wonderful. They're such a big part of the band and the show, you know, both from Nashville, and Catrice Ford is wonderful. I found Jackie Wilson through James Pennebaker and Catrice through Jackie, and that's how that all came about. And it's just such a wonderful group of people, and they're fun to be around.
I'm sure it's a fun show.
It is a really fun show. It's really fun for me every night. So I think that's the thing that comes across much as anything else. I think it's disarming to see someone having a lot of fun. And I think a lot of times people come in expecting one thing and leave with a feeling another way. And that's a good thing.
So cool. Love it. Love it. And of course, you're the son of legendary Jim Croce.
Yes.
Amazing. One legend to another. Do you remember him at all? You were so young when he passed.
You know, I was very fortunate to have a lot of home recordings. Not a lot of video, a little bit with him, but a lot of home recordings. He recorded everything because he was always writing or hanging out with friends and wanting to capture a song that he was going to play at a show. So, you know, when I was born, he hadn't yet recorded his first album, and it was a make or break moment for him. He had to decide whether he was going to really put everything into being a musician and a writer and a performer and artist, or get a real day job. You know, he had avoided it for almost 10 years. You know, he stayed in college as long as he could and got 2 master's degrees and came out and worked as many odd jobs as he could to avoid a real job, because what he really wanted to do was play music, which he finally got to in the last 18 months of his life. And you only, if you realize, like, everything you know of his was written, recorded, and toured in 18 months. So, yeah, I'm really fortunate to be able to have those home recordings and get to know him through his conversations with friends, family, to me. It's really special. And the other thing that really came about at an early age was my recognition of the music that he left. Not just the music he wrote and created and recorded, but his record collection. It was profoundly influential, and one of his jobs was being a DJ, and he had such a variety of music. You know, as a kid, I lost my sight at 4, and being turned on to Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder and all of the great blind blues artists of the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, it was all really influential. Ray Charles was my gateway drug, but after that, it was like there was so much good music of all genres. That's what really sparked my interest in music. I didn't hear Ray Charles being different than the Rolling Stones or Lee Dorsey or Fats Waller or Ellington or Stevie Wonder. It was all great, beautiful. It was soulful. Hank Williams was soulful, and Jimmy Rogers was soulful, and all of these things, that the best music is soulful, regardless of where it comes from. And so that was what really inspired me to want to do what I do.
How did you know you had the gift? When did you know?
I don't know that I ever thought I had the gift. I felt like I had the patience to practice. I was inspired to want to practice piano. And I practiced, you know, 5-6 hours a day, every day. It was before school, after school. It was a joy. And as I got better at the instrument, it became a lot easier to practice, because I was practicing for a goal. Oh, I want to be able to play this style, or I want to play this piece. I was never interested in copying note for note a piece of music. So, you know, the first real kind of heavy style of music that was like very complicated and physically demanding was stride piano. So with guys like James P. Johnson, Willie the Lion Smith, and Fats Waller, they had bigger hands than I have. They could reach these 13ths. They could reach these 10ths with their eyes closed. For me, it was like I can only reach those in certain keys, you know? And so it became, for me, a way to learn. How do I access this? It's some of the most challenging music of the 20th century. How do I learn how to do this? And it was all by ear. And it came through simplifying it. You know, it came through simplifying it just as rock and roll simplified the boogie-woogie of the 30s and 40s. I learned what made it work, never tried to play it note for note, not that I necessarily could in the case of, some of those players, but I wanted to be able to understand how it worked. And same thing with music in general. It's not just how to play it, but like, why does it make me feel like this? You know, it's the same thing in reading a great story or a poem or even watching a great film is wondering, like, what is it that makes me feel this way about this scene? It's not immediately obvious, but it's emotional. And I don't think I'm the only one that feels this way. And that's what I love about music.
Love it. And how old were you when you started the piano?
I started playing when I was just a baby. I mean, I was crawling up to the keys, and as long as I can remember, I was playing. And after I lost my sight, I had a little transistor radio set to the Mighty 690, and it was like a kind of a top 40 radio station and broadcast out of Tijuana. And I would hear a song, and this is 1970s, so I would hear a song by the Stones or ELO or Elton John or McCartney or John Lennon, someone, whoever was on the charts at the moment, and run to the piano and try and play along. And it was in that I, started to understand popular music and the form and how it worked. And it became sort of an understanding of more than just the mechanics of it.
And you couldn't see, and you still kept playing.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I don't think that when you're moved by something emotionally, when you're inspired, inspiration doesn't come from vision or from hearing. It comes from your heart. It comes from your emotion of your mind and what you're thinking and how profound it might be to you in a moment, in any given moment. You know, it's why, people have asked, what's your favorite song? Do you have a favorite artist? No, music is about emotion and mood. And we need to, I think, really, in thinking of things that way, really just understand, at least for myself I do, that every day I'm going to have a different favorite. You know, every hour I might, within the hour. I mean, I might hear something and then I'm like, oh, there's another song that reminds me of this. And then I'm like, oh, this is so great. How can it, And then I reach out to a friend who's also loves this. And I'm like, isn't this amazing? Like, how did they do this? How did they make this feel this way? You know, and I'm a student of life and music and art. And so I will always be interested in understanding and trying to understand at least.
And by the time, you were 21, you played with both B.B. King and Ray Charles.
I did. So it really started. So when I was 16, I got to play with a guy named Floyd Dixon. He was a boogie-woogie piano player and songwriter, famous for his drinking songs. He wrote Wine, Wine, Wine and Hey Bartender and One Scotch, One Bourbon, One Beer. And he was a fixture on the Central Avenue L.A. scene. And he heard me play in San Diego and asked if I would open the shows for him. So I started opening shows for him, and there were a number of kind of well-known blues artists who came to see him perform, and they consequently saw me perform. And he would always, impart these pearls of wisdom, like, after the show, AJ, always dress up for the audience, and whatever you do, always get paid in cash, and, things like this. And he would tell me these, great old stories of hanging out with this person or that person. And he was just an eccentric. He was a total character. And that kind of led to giving me a certain amount of confidence, as a player. You know, I think it was shortly after I was, you know, running around doing those shows with him that a woman named Mae Axton heard me play. Mae Axton wrote Heartbreak Hotel for Elvis. She's also Hoyt's mother and just a really wonderful woman. She heard me play and called up Jack Clement, Cowboy Jack, and said, "You got to hire this kid." And I was 17. That was my first session. And so, you know, I'll be honest, that was my very first session. I didn't know what I was walking into. And he's in Nashville. He flies me to Nashville. And I'm walking into the studio and Jerry Lee Lewis is walking out. And I don't realize I'm filling in for Jerry Lee Lewis. And I'm like, recording all, and I get in there and it's Elvis's band. If you're not familiar with Cowboy Jack Clement, he was the engineer and producer of the Million Dollar Quartet in Memphis on Sun Records. He was staff producer, engineer, songwriter, you know, bon vivant for Sun Records from 1953 to 1960. And worked with all of those artists, and most notably Johnny Cash, who he worked with for as long as he was alive. So when I walk in knowing this history, I'm looking at James Burton and Tut and Jerry Sheff, and it's like Elvis's band, his 68, you know, band. I'm like, oh my God. I think after that session, I was like, I know what I need to practice. I don't think I was great. I think I did a fine job, you know, but obviously he had some of the best people in the field doing this recording. And what I really took away was A, I know what I need to practice, and B, I think that this is going to lead me down a path that's kind of unique in that I may not be a celebrity because of doing this. I'm outside the box. There's not really another piano player who's my age who's doing what I do. Now, I mean, I was drawing from a lot of different places. In that case, from like the rockabilly and rock and roll and that kind of boogie piano style that Jerry Lee and Little Richard and Fats Domino were famous for in the 50s. That was where that came in handy. But of course, the New Orleans music was always a part of my heart. And it was really in that moment that I realized I might not fit into like a box very easily. This is not necessarily going to be easy, especially because I didn't want to use my father's name and fame to propel myself. I needed to do it on my own abilities. I needed to do it because people heard me and said, he's great at what he does. Mm-hmm. That's how it happened, because I couldn't have gone out on the road with B.B. King without having built that confidence and having prepared for that. Same thing with Ray Charles or Aretha or James Brown or Willie or any of the people that I've been really so Nelson, fortunate right. to right. Have sat in with or played with or written with. Leon Russell was a person who I was always, you know, fan of. Leon had this wonderful style. I really understood it because of my record collection as a kid. He and I had the same record collection. So it was like when we met and like started connecting before we ever wrote together, Leon and I could just talk about piano players for hours, you know, bore everyone else around us, but be completely, you know, wrapped in this amazing conversation that inspired us both, you know. So that's kind of how we came to work together.
What's Willie Nelson like?
Well, it's been a while since I've seen him, but he is one of the few people that I could say that off stage and on stage, he's the same man. He is what you see is what you get. He's real, down to earth, funny, irreverent, generous human being.
And you've written for so many people too. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think sometimes if you're writing for a film or television or you're writing for an artist, you know, I spent years, a period of time where I wasn't touring as much. And you know, this career is a roller coaster ride. Being a musician, even some of the most famous musicians, you know, have ups and downs in their careers. And for me, it was one of those down periods where I was, this is all I can do. I'm a musician. I've worked in publishing, and I've worked as a musician and running a small indie label, and I understand how this business works. But it was in that time that I really started doing a lot of sessions, 2008, 2009, when I first moved to Nashville, doing all kinds of unusual projects, from K-pop to, you know, working with Japanese artists, doing commercials for Asia through Japanese agencies in Tokyo, and writing for the Olympics and writing for this and that. It was really came about in an unusual fashion. And it was also in that time I was collaborating, probably 95 co-writes. I looked at my calendar not long ago. It was 95 co-writes 1 year, 92 the other. In that two or three year period, I was just working with someone almost every day of the week, you know, and I got really good at the formula, you know. It's this song is for so-and-so. They want a song that sounds exactly like their last hit, but a little different, you know. How do you make it exactly like their last hit without, you know, how do you do that? Well, you have to really listen to what was good about the hit song, and then kind of reverse engineer it in a way, you know? And in that way, even though that's not my preferred way of writing by any means, it was a learning experience. And I love learning, and I love the challenge of writing with a theme or an artist in mind, because it gives me the ability to contribute to the greater good.
So great. What does music do for people?
I think at its best, music stops time. I think music has the ability to completely captivate an audience in a number of ways, but in the live setting, it allows people to completely forget about their day, completely forget about the outside world, outside of that venue, and be at one and unified with everyone in that space. There are very few spaces where we all agree. In a space for listening to music and hearing music, that is one of those places where we can all agree, because we're being moved emotionally. I think the other side of how music is really powerful in this way and stops time is that when you hear a song that moves you, and there are certain things going on in your life, whether you're a teenager and emotional about everything, or you're in your 20s and you don't really know what your future is going to be, or in your 30s and wondering whether the path you took is the right one, it doesn't matter what age you are. When you hear a song and it becomes sort of identified with that time in your life, and that song doesn't need to have been written at that time. It could be 100 years old. It could be the number one song on the chart, or it could be something that is just a deep cut on a record that moves you and you hear it, and forever, time has stood still. You are in that space when you hear that song. I think there were times where I've had this happen in a really curious fashion, in that, for example, when I was a kid, Cat Stevens was popular on the radio, and I always felt a connection because my father had known him, and he gave me this really beautiful book, children's book of Teaser and the Fire Cat, and it was lost in a fire. So I had this very personal connection to that music, but completely outside of family and just time and the era of which this music was created and the art was created. I was on a trip with my late wife, and we were in Turkey, and we're in this little dive bar on the coast of Turkey, and the only album they have is Cat Stevens, and it's that album. And I'll tell you, it was in that moment where, like, that music in that moment, all of a sudden, it wasn't my childhood anymore. I was in my, you know, late 20s, and this was a new experience, and all of a sudden the memory of it as a child, it was erased and replaced by the memory of being in this moment where this is the only thing that they play is this one cassette, you know. And so, you know, you ask me how music affects us, and it, you know, of course it affects us in all different ways, but I think the most profound thing about music is that it stops time.
Time in a bottle. Mm-hmm. Like that someone too. Wrote.
Yeah, absolutely.
The fire, too, another thing you've been through. Mm-hmm. with all you've been through, how do you stay positive in life, since this is Life Minute? Life tips we go over as well.
You know, I think that we have a choice every day about how we want to react to the things around us and how we choose to digest them, you know, emotionally and psychologically, and how do we come to terms with the world around us every day. And I found that through humor and kindness and forgiveness, I'm able to look at the world in a really positive way. And I can see that, you know, you need to deal with those parts of life that are painful. You can't just disregard them. You can't just put them in a box and put them away. You have to look at it all. You have to investigate your experiences and give them their due, because it's just, they become part of who we are. And if we don't investigate that, then we kind of lose track of who we are and why we feel certain ways. And so I think that by being open and aware and forgiving and having a sense of humor, that we always find a way through.
Good answer. How's your mom doing?
She's doing pretty well. She has Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. and she has had a speech aphasia for about 8 years. And she's not really able to communicate mm-hmm. any longer, but she can say yes, and which is the opposite of what she said when I was growing up. and I'll be honest, she's very, very happy. My stepfather is a wonderful, wonderful human. I love him dearly, and I talk to him multiple times a week and talk to her, even though she isn't able to really say much. And one of the amazing things about the brain that I've come to see and learn is, you know, she's very present when I'm with her. She's not able to say anything. That changes when I start playing a song. And she can sing any song. She can't speak, but she can sing. You know, if it's one of my dad's songs, one of my songs, you know, I heard her playing guitar and singing this Leonard Cohen song that had like 15 verses. And I'm just like completely in awe of the fact that she's still able to play fingerstyle guitar, and she's still able to sing a song all the way through, but she can't talk.
Wow.
And so wherever possible, whenever possible, I bring her out and have her join me on stage sing a song or two. And I know she loves it still. And it's really special, because we never played music together when I was growing up. You know, she sort of lost her voice and it had vocal cord surgery, and as in the 80s. And so she never really sang after that. It wasn't until she couldn't speak that she started to sing.
Wow, that's amazing. Wow. What do you mean she said no to you when you were young? I was going to ask you that. Like, she's the one who must have noticed when you're a baby, like, oh my gosh, she has the gift.
Two things about that. One is that when I say that she said no to me, she was a very busy person. She was a workaholic, you know. She was trying to manage the legacy of my father's music, which was not easy. And there were a lot of lawsuits and things through my childhood that were really difficult for her. She also had gone through a lot with, you know, because of what happened to me and the consequences of the blindness and where it all came from. She was, you know, vice consulate of Costa Rica. She ran restaurants and bars. She had nightclubs. She was a really busy person. And so I think that because of that, she couldn't say yes as often, you know, or she didn't. And so no, I heard a lot more often than yes. Can I do this? No. Can I go here? No. And then she'd think about it and go, no, it's okay. Yeah, you know.
But she was supportive of your music career.
You know, she was supportive of my music at a certain point. I think that she really wanted me to go to college, and it was not that I didn't want to go to college, because I love learning. It was that I knew what I wanted to do. And so I think by the time I was 15, I was good enough. I think I had gotten to a place as a musician that was, I think she felt like, okay, he can make this work. I think before then, you know, she didn't know. She knew it wasn't going to be easy, and she knew that, like, I'm really stubborn, and I wasn't going to play my dad's stuff, and that wasn't where I wanted to go. I wanted integrity, you know? There wasn't going to be integrity if I just jumped into playing Leroy Brown. So it was, I think, in that she was protective but also encouraging. And then at a certain point, she knew that, like, this is, yeah, you've got something. And then she really became proud of what I am. And I think she, you know, she told a lot of people, you know, well, what is his music like? And she was so supportive at a certain point, you know, 18 years old, 19 years old. She's like, if you like Jim, you're going to be blown away. He is next level, you know, piano player, and you're going to love it. And she was my biggest cheerleader for a period of time, you know? And I think that, you know, we had like all families, we had challenging times, and there were ups and downs, and that's just the way families are. But when she, you know, when I discovered that she had the speech aphasia and that she was, you know, it was degenerative, and I could really, really hear it. It brought us closer, and it changed our dynamic as a family and as friends, you know.
That's beautiful. Mm. Well, she did good.
Thank you.
Amazing. Anything else you want to tell us that I didn't cover?
The thing I was thinking about, I was sitting with a friend last night, and we were talking about just life in general, and he's a journalist, and we weren't talking as me being interviewed by him. It was just that I've done thousands of interviews, and so many of them focus on the tragedy, you know, and then tragedy struck, and then you've been through this and this and this, and I just want people to know that I'm in love, that I have a new chapter, that life is great. And it hurts me to know that like to think that people think that, you know, that they should pity me in some way, because I feel so grateful to have a new lease on life and love and happiness and a future forward. So I just think it's really important that people know that, but also in their own lives know that it's absolutely possible.
Beautiful. I love it. Oh, I'm so happy for you too. Oh,
thank you.
Yeah. I don't think that. But your just aura is so positive. So I, you know, but you have been through a lot.
Yeah, of course.
I'm so happy that you're with somebody else.
Oh,
want to tell
you.
Us more about that? No.
she loves getting credit, but I don't think, you know, I think that it's kind of interesting. I had such a difficult time with celebrity and sort of renown growing up. You know, it was hard to have an identity of my own with a father who was so kind of iconic as my father was. And as much as I loved music and realized that I needed to have a certain amount of recognition to be able to make another record and go on tour and fill the seats that are, you know, I struggled for so many years writing this, you know, balancing act of how do I stay true to myself and true to the music and also be a public figure. It was the challenge of the first half of my life or more was finding this way of dealing with notoriety or recognition. And I never felt famous. I never embraced it. I never looked for it. I looked for inspiration. I looked for a way to be great at what I do. So it was at a certain point, some years back, maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago, where I realized I need to tell the world about who I am. I need to let people know that, you know, I'm doing something that's really unique. I want people to know it. I'm proud of it, and I'm proud of who I am. And I think that it took me a long time to feel that way. And I think that's something a lot of people go through in this world in all different ways, not even having nothing to do with fame or celebrity, but just feeling a sense of peace with themselves and feeling worthy of recognition and worthy of love.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, you are excellent and you are different and you're so beautiful. I love
you. Thank you so much.
I'm so glad that you came to that realization.
Well, thank you.
To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.